Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, my name is Bassam Zahid, and welcome to episode 8. Storytelling is a practice that has been proven to build community, inspire empathy, and incite change. So when you combine that with medicine and go beyond the science, the algorithms, and the data, you'll find the art in medicine that our next guest is an expert in cultivating. Dr. AJ Major is an internal medicine resident, healthcare activist, and a physician publisher passionate about narrative medicine. He has co-founded multiple online publications, including In Training, a magazine for medical students, In-House, a magazine for residents and fellows, and The Palate, a magazine for medical students at the intersection of nutrition and public health. More recently, he has helped found Pager Publications, a nonprofit publishing house that curates and supports peer-edited publications for the medical education community. His publications don't just provide the patient and physician stories that move us, but also shine light on issues from racial injustice and healthcare inequity that inspire us. After hearing his story, don't be surprised if you're compelled to action. That's precisely the point. So, Dr. Major, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you're a man of many identities, right? You're a doctor, you're an entrepreneur, you're a journalist, you're an activist. Is one of these identities one that you're particularly proud of?
It's a good question. I kind of switch in between all of, change all of those hats from time to time. I think the one that I'm most proud of is probably the kind of publishing entrepreneurship realm with the work I've been doing with Pager Publications, kind of finding a niche for people in all sorts of medical education to have a place to kind of publish their unique work. I think that's probably what I'm most proud of.
So take us back to the beginning of your career in journalism. Which I read somewhere that you started in undergrad, but can you just kind of take us back to that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, in undergrad, I was the editor-in-chief of my college paper, the Concordiensis, for a couple of years. And when I started at Albany Medical College, I really wanted to continue the publishing work I was doing. And me and one of my dear friends, Alina Paul, who was in medical school with me, you know, we kind of were deciding the best way to continue our journalism interests. And we ended up basically coming up with this idea of starting an online magazine for medical students, which eventually became In Training, in-training.org. And when we started the publication, we initially thought it was going to be more of a newspaper. It was going to be medical students writing about news and, you know, what was going on in kind of all of medical education. And what we found very quickly after our inception is that people were actually submitting all sorts of humanism kind of related works, you know, first experiences in the anatomy lab, first patients, the trials and tribulations of, you know, burnout and transitions throughout medical training. And so we kind of figured out that actually this was kind of a deeply unfilled niche that medical students were wanting to talk about was kind of humanities. And so we kind of retooled In Training more as a humanities kind of derived publication. 4 years later, we, you know, were starting to get ready to go to our own residencies. And we said, hey, you know, In Training always has to remain in the hands of medical students. So the editor-in-chief always have to be a medical student. And so we still wanted to be able to support the publication as we moved on in the rest of our careers. And so Alina and I started this online, or rather started this 501c3 nonprofit corporation called Pager Publications, which eventually, you know, spawned In-House, which is the online peer-reviewed publication for residents and fellows, The Palate, which is a publication at the intersection of nutrition and public health. And then we actually acquired a publication called North Wing Magazine out of Sheffield in United Kingdom, which is an old medical student newspaper that got started actually in the 1940s. And we published a couple books in the interim as well. So I kind of never intended Pager Publications to become this kind of nidus for young writers and authors, both online as well as in print. But that's kind of how this whole career that I've started for myself kind of was born.
But even before college, were you interested in journalism in high school?
You know, it's interesting because in high school, I actually did a lot of more like multimedia work. Like I started a club at my high school that was all about kind of recording and doing video production. My foray into journalism really started actually freshman, like my first week of college. I went to the local kind of club fair and I said, I'll try my hand with writing for a newspaper. And a year later, I was kind of the editor of the Worldview and science and technology sections. And then it kind of snowballed from there. So it was something I kind of stumbled into just because I wanted to try something new in college.
And did you think it was easy to pick up for you? Or was there like a learning curve for you to learn, you know, techniques of journalism or how to write a story and things like that?
It was totally a learning curve. I mean, the way I started was, writing kind of worldviews and science and technology pieces, which, working with the editors there is definitely, you know, the kind of writing you do for a newspaper audience is pretty different from any other kind of academic writing. So definitely a learning curve. And then when I was an editor there, and I had a great mentor who was a kind of an old school newspaper editor at the local kind of actual, you know, print newspaper, who would, you know, come in for all of our meetings and kind of give us the lowdown on what publishing really meant. But the world of publishing, especially in newspaper, kind of like print journalism, is totally different from anything I'd done before. And there was a couple of years of kind of learning and learning by trial and error, and, you know, sometimes publishing the stuff that wasn't necessarily the right thing and publishing things that were well received and kind of iteratively learning from that process that, you know, before I could finally feel more or less confident with the work I was doing.
You've had a co-founder in all these publications, Alina Paul. So, you know, we kind of hear a lot about co-founders and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. So what do you think that you guys had that made it work through all these different publications that you can kind of give advice on?
Yeah. So, you know, we first met. So Alina and I actually, we both did the same 8-year BS MBA MD program through Union College and Albany Medical College. So, you know, I've known her for, gosh, 10 years now, and she's a dear friend of mine. She actually was managing editor of the Concordiensis, my school, my undergraduate paper, while I was editor in chief. And so we had worked together, in the newsroom for hours and hours and hours for many, many years. And then when we both started Albany Medical College, you know, we said, hey, you know, we both have this kind of mutual interest and wanted to get together to found something and, you know, have been founding partners for a lot of these endeavors. I think what really works well for us is that we definitely have some, you know, we both have a business background, but the way that we kind of approach business is a little bit different. So like in her training, she focused a lot on kind of like people management, building hierarchies. And I was focusing a little bit more on kind of some of the finances in terms of our business education. So we kind of brought those two different components to the table. But I think what it comes at the end of the day is that we are not afraid to kind of really challenge each other when we're coming up with decisions for all of these, you know, publications and organizations we've started. You know, she definitely reels me in. I'm kind of a wacky and wild idea person. I joke that I'm kind of more of the hypomanic type. And she really has this like crystal clear, realistic view of what is practical and what is achievable. And so, you know, we'll just get on the phone for hours at a time and just like talk over ideas. And, you know, we're always kind of accessible by text, by phone. You know, she'll text me an idea and then, you know, we'll text some ideas back and forth. But she kind of provides that pragmatic view to kind of some of the ideas that I generate. And that combination historically has worked really well for us in finding all these publications. I think it's finding someone who brings a totally different perspective and skill set to the table. And also someone that honestly you can kind of argue with in a critical and practical way that can, and not getting offended by it, saying like, you know, I appreciate these ideas that you're bringing and that this conversation is like a key component to actually, you know, building these new organizations and publications.
So what advice can you give to us if I wanted to start something with a partner? You know, what are certain ground rules we might have to set out to kind of make a partnership work, for example?
So I think the ground rules you have to set out first and foremost is what the overall vision and mission for your organization are, and making sure that everyone who's on a co-founding committee intrinsically agrees with what your vision and mission are. For example, when Alina and I actually founded in-house, we were still medical students. And so we actually brought together a group of residents who had been basically in-training writers who had graduated into residency, and even some who were fellows. And we got them all together on a call and we said, you know, what do you, as brand new residents and fellows, what do you want out of a publication that is meant to serve you? And they, as a whole group, came together with this kind of unified vision and mission that they all felt that they had some, you know, that they were invested in, they had some vested interest in. And basically that founding committee became everyone who kind of agreed with that core mission and vision of what the publication ended up, you know, wanting to become. I think if you're on a founding board and you find that there's some kind of, you know, people can't all agree upon what is actually going to happen with an organization. And I've, you know, talked with people who want to start publications and say, you know, well, our editorial board doesn't agree on this and doesn't agree on what we're trying to achieve. I think that's kind of already a red flag. I think finding people where you can all agree at least on what you want to accomplish is the first part. And then once you've kind of built that foundation, then it's a matter of coming up with and setting some foundational rules for how we want to communicate and discuss what will become of this publication. And so that's as simple as, like, Alina and I basically, actually as first year medical students, we lived in the same apartment. And so we kind of had ground rules. We were like, okay, every once a week, we're going to sit down for an hour and we're going to just like hash it out. We're going to duke it out. We're going to say, okay, this is what I've been thinking about for the week about this. And, you know, and we're going to have basically a time for us to kind of have an open discussion space where we didn't feel like we were going to take offense to anything and just like hash it out in that hour. And that was like our agreement week after week. I think when organizations agree to have some dedicated time to really like, what are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? What are, you know, I'm thinking about like a traditional SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, strengths, like doing that kind of iteratively on a weekly basis and having a place where you can just hash it out is 100% kind of a core kind of ground rule to build an organization to, you know, get those ideas out there.
And this is kind of jumping ahead to a question I had later on about time management and things like that. But now that you're at residency and she's at residency and the team is kind of diffuse, mm-hmm. is this whole hashing out process, does now it has to happen virtually?
Yeah, and actually that's all of our publications in Training In-House, The Palette, North Wing Magazine, and also Patreon Publications, all the work we do has been decentralized and virtual, which actually I think has been one of the greatest strengths of all of our publications, and I think ultimately why, for example, In Training has been going 6 years now and published, you know, over 1,400 pieces in those 6 years. It's because with the demands of medical student, resident, fellow type schedule, it really allows you to be flexible with when you're doing the work during the day. And yes, a lot of the work we do does happen virtually. I mean, Alina and I routinely will, you know, say, you know, she'll be waking up after a 30-hour call and, you know, we'll get on a call, we'll open up Google Drive, we'll open up a document, we'll like actively edit it together, you know, to be able to kind of spitball ideas. You know, we do have editorial board meetings for a lot of our publications and, you know, we are as flexible as we can, having them at weird hours of the night. And that's kind of what you have to do. But I actually like a virtual model because I think it really works with the kind of constraints of what everyone's schedule is so different in residency. And it's worked really, really well for us. But yeah, a lot of it is Google Drive, text. I mean, I have a text thread on my phone with the editors in chief of pretty much all of our publications where they'll just text me something and a day later I'll respond. It's, you kind of have to be willing and open to use a lot of different forms of communication in order to kind of make these kind of publications work.
And is there anything that you've learned about managing a team that you might be able to share?
Yeah, 100%. I think especially with people who are in the medical field doing any kind of work in organizations or entrepreneurship is you really have to build roles that allow the work to be appropriately dispersed among a team. And so what I mean by that is when we first started in training for the first 2 years, basically Alina and I and our editors were basically doing all of the day-to-day work, which ultimately ends up being quite laborious for, you know, a growing publication. So about a year and a half into In Training, we found a medical student in Canada who had actually a decent amount of social media and publishing experience, who we brought on as a managing editor. And she was phenomenal. She built the entire organizational scheme for basically all of the logistics, which is how the publication works today. She built an entire enormous Excel spreadsheet to kind of track all of these publications as they were going through our editorial process. She built all of these protocols. She actually helped us automate a lot of our kind of back end processes. You know, we used to have to manually email writers when they were interested. And then we built a whole system where when they filled out our interest form, it automatically emailed them with the entire instructions for how to create an account, how to submit their article. We built an entire system on the back end where when people email or when editors kind of put comments on articles that automatically emailed the writer so they were always in the know. I mean, she really helped us with a lot of those components. So finding out when you can automate things to kind of take the human component completely out of it, and then building roles where people can kind of do some of the day-to-day work is so critical. I mean, none of the work I'd be doing with any of these organizations would be possible if we didn't have, you know, people whose dedicated job it was is to do certain tasks. So for example, all of our publications have a social media manager, and their entire job is just, and actually it's sub, so in training, there's like a Twitter social media manager, Facebook, Tumblr. And every morning at 9 a.m., anytime any articles are published on in training, they automatically, all of those social media managers get an email. And so they automatically every day are in the know about what's been published and kind of to be able to keep all of our social media alive. So a lot of kind of process management to make sure that you know, basically there's not an undue amount of work on any given person, because, you know, whenever someone has to pick up the bulk of the work, things just don't thrive, you know, with the schedule that we have.
And all your entire team is built on volunteers?
Mm-hmm. Yep. All of the in-training in-house, the Palette, North Wing Magazine, and all page publications are all completely run by volunteer, you know, med students, residents, fellows, what have you. So yeah, we're entirely based on kind of on a volunteer system.
Cool. And then one of the things I also read was in an effort to maintain the nonprofit model, you guys do not want to have ads on your site or make people pay for the content. So do you see in training or in-house or the Palette ever evolving as into a more traditional journalistic outlet? Like, I mean, there are some out there like Kevin MD that's sure. Nonprofit also, and Kaiser Health News that's more journalistic, that's also a nonprofit. What do you think about sustainability or even trying to, you know, create more long-form pieces that are more of the traditional journalism that we usually see?
So that, I mean, that's a great question. The reason we decided early on we didn't want ads is I wanted to create platforms that were devoid. I mean, there's plenty of organizations out there that kind of want to cater to a medical student audience, especially when it comes to test prep and stuff like that. And I just felt that would detract ultimately from what we were trying to do, which is present a low barrier to entry and open access community for, at least for in training, for medical students all around the world to read about what other medical students were doing and to kind of find some sense of catharsis in that. I felt if people had to pay and there were ads, I think that would kind of detract from that experience of creating a true online community. As far as kind of these traditional, you know, journalistic pursuits, you know, we do actually publish a decent amount of long form pieces that people, you know, spend time writing, especially when it comes into the areas of kind of discussing institutional issues with sexism, racism. People have published plenty of long form on both in training and in house. At the core of what we do is, and the whole mission of Page Publications is to provide the community of medical education with a peer edited and peer reviewed spaces. And so in training, for example, has evolved since my time and my tenure as an editor-in-chief. And the whole idea is that all of our publications are meant to be organic. They're meant to change with the natural evolution of the medical student community. So I can tell you, looking at in training, I mean, like I said, when we started it was very much talking about patient stories and reflections on the medical student experience. But looking back over the past couple of years, there's been a huge shift on in training to works talking about social justice. I mean, there's a ton of columns there now that are on a number of institutional issues that have come up, you know, since Ferguson and some, you know, Black Lives Matter and White Coats for Black Lives, you know. And then there's also a bunch of work on that has been published on in training as well as in house with issues of burnout and mental health in the, you know, medical student as well as resident and fellow, you know, house staff communities, which I think actually has reflected a larger paradigm shift within a lot of medical education. I mean, we now hear, I mean, you're well aware of this in the residency world about the issue of burnout in residents, mm-hmm. but medical students were talking about that in training a couple of years ago. I mean, that's what I love about these publications is that they're meant to reflect the pulse of all of these communities. And so, you know, if these will eventually evolve to something that's, you know, more of a traditional Kaiser Health News kind of model, maybe. And, you know, if that's the way that the publication goes, of course, I'll, you know, 100% support it. We do have a news section on In Training that does talk about some news topics. But to be honest, the niche that In Training and House fill is not really in traditional news. I mean, Kaiser Health News, you know, STAT, all those kind of organizations kind of already have filled that niche of talking about medical news. You know, the niche that we fill is much more born from within the community and something that didn't really exist before In Training. And so I kind of actually like that that's the niche that we fill. So if we do evolve one day, that'll be great. I would welcome that. But, you know, right now I think we're serving the community in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. Appreciate that. What's readership like?
Yeah. So In Training right now is, I can actually pull up the dedicated stats for you. Readership has been steadily increasing for all of our publications over time. In Training now manages, let's see, about 100,000 page views a month. Wow. So that ends up being, yeah, greater than about 1,000 page views a day. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's been probably a couple million page views over the life of that publication. Our other publications in-house and The Palette are definitely smaller, primarily because of the niche that they serve. But in-house staff now, we're managing about 40 to 50,000 page views a month as well as we grow. And again, in-house is a little bit younger. So it's a pretty big kind of, especially because, you know, the overall niche we serve, which is the medical student community, is, you know, smaller than that, like Kaiser Health and Stat News and things like that, or Kevin MD for that matter. So yeah, but our stat traffic has been, you know, steadily growing over time.
That's awesome. And did you ever imagine it would get this big when you started?
Never. No. Pager Publications also is kind of, I've been surprised at how we've kind of built ourselves as a publishing house, because we wanted to start In Training more kind of honestly for our own purposes. You know, Alina and I loved working in publishing and wanted to kind of start our own project. And I think what was fortunate is we really found the niche that was completely unserved, and we continue to, I mean, on In Training, I think there's probably about 100 pieces that are in some form of the editorial process. I mean, people are really loving to submit their work, and, you know, we now have kind of a brand named to us, and people really trust us as a place that really publishes kind of meaningful work. Did I intend that to happen 6 years ago? Absolutely not. Did I intend In Training to be running autonomously 6 years without my intervention? No. But, you know, I think what that reflects is that there was a growing desire in the medical student community to have peer-reviewed places to publish medical student work, because they didn't exist before In Training. I mean, journals rarely published medical student works, and places like Kevin MD, you know, they kind of serve a different niche. You know, there's something attractive, and I've talked to writers about this, that they say, you know, I've had plenty of writers come up to me and said, I've never written before, you know, and I want to try my hand at writing, and I love that, you know, it's going to be my peers that are going to be looking at my piece, and it's not going to be going through some crazy peer review process. You know, a lot of writers really like that. And I like to think of all of these publications as being kind of a place for writers to experiment to be able to kind of develop their own voices.
That's awesome. And speaking of pager publications, I like the idea, because it's almost like you're now moving into print media also.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about pager publications? Is it like the alphabet to your Google now?
Yeah, in some ways. So the pager publications kind of has two big components. So the first component, which is why we started the publication, was to provide administrative and financial support to these online communities, like In Training and in-house. So we provide all of that administrative and financial support, and we're actually in the process of acquiring a fifth publication, which will, you know, soon to be released. And that's what we do, is we provide support for these publications. The second arm of pager publications is more of our publishing house. And so that is primarily our revenue generating means of being able to support all of these publications. So we've published two print books so far. The first one was back in 2016 in April. That was entitled In Training: Stories from Tomorrow's Physicians, which was a compendium of medical student thought. It was meant to represent kind of a snapshot of the institutional memory of medical students from the first about 3 to 4 years of in-training's inception. And so it was marketed as a kind of chicken soup type book for the medical student soul. It featured about 100 pieces over in-training's initial couple of years, and all of them were accompanied by discussion questions that were meant to kind of serve as a reflective, a reflective resource for medical students. And so that book has actually been picked up by at least two institutions as a curriculum, as a curricular supplement. And so that was kind of what that book was intended to do. And we published it in conjunction with the Gold Humanism Honor Society as well. Our second book was very much something different. It was entitled Family Doc Diary, A Resident, A Physician's Reflections in 52 Entries. One of my colleagues, actually from medical school, is a practices art journaling. And so journaled basically her entire, every week for her entire first year of family medicine residency, these like beautiful full color, very poignant journals that kind of reflected on everything from the, you know, day-to-day trials and tribulations to kind of these more meaningful issues of what it meant to become a family physician. And so we published her work as kind of a reproduction of her own art journal back in November of 2017, which actually she's going to be speaking here at University of Colorado, giving a lecture in about a couple of weeks about kind of her process for why she thinks that journaling should, you know, can be an integral part of the daily practice of clinicians. And so that's kind of the two big print books. We're in, I just finished laying out our third book, which will be In Training Volume 2, which the last two editors in chief kind of curated. And that's going to be more of a thematic book, exploring themes like, you know, choosing a specialty and first patients. Again, you know, capitalizing in these 1400 pieces that we've published on In Training. And I've got a couple of other books that are in the works as well, which are to be announced. But I suspect the next year we'll probably get a couple more books published as well.
That's awesome. So is Pager Publications open for people to pitch their ideas also?
Absolutely. That's primarily the purpose we serve. Again, we want to publish print work, or ebooks for that matter. We want to publish works that are generated from within the medical student or actually medical education community. One of my books is going to be coming from a fellow. And we want to be able to, again, provide a place for trainees to publish when they wouldn't otherwise be able to. I think that's the number one kind of frustration I've heard from trainees is they, you know, they have these works they want to publish and they just can't find a publisher to help them with that. And that's, you know, for a number of kind of financial reasons that a lot of publishers won't look at kind of smaller authors. And we want to be able to remove that barrier. And we can offer actually a much better cut of proceeds to authors than a lot of publishers would otherwise do. So that's kind of the niche that we serve. And yeah, we're open to pitches of any kind.
So I have a couple more questions about like entrepreneurship before we go on to your other part of your history. In a number of places, part of the story is that you were told before you started In Training, essentially like go big or go home, right? Like if you're going to do something, go big with it. Can you talk about that sentiment and how can other students or doctors apply that idea to their own lives?
Yeah. So the context in which we kind of got that advice was when we were deciding whether or not to, like what kind of publication we wanted to start at the beginning of medical school. We actually were at the SNMA National Conference and met with a kind of renowned journalist at that time. And, you know, she gave us the advice saying like, you know, this is the day of kind of social media and being online. I mean, the day, unfortunately, of a lot of print publications is kind of waning. And so the advice she gave us is, you know, there is a enormous community to be found on the internet. So Go Big or Go Home really referred to capitalizing on being able to reach a large international market through kind of a virtual model. And I think a lot of organizations in the CNA that are kind of entrepreneur based really serve to benefit from accessing that larger community. I mean, we at In Training have been publishing medical student works in numerous countries for a couple of years now. And that's primarily because, you know, we have a Twitter presence. We have a Tumblr presence. I mean, Tumblr's got an enormous community of pre-medical and medical students on it that we've kind of been able to tap into. And, you know, those people are from all over the globe. And to be able to kind of build their experiences into the larger narrative of what it means to be a doctor in training is huge. So I think that's what the larger sentiment of Go Big or Go Home really refers to is really reaching for the and really saturating your niche, whatever it may be, as best you can. I mean, our niche was the medical student community, and we, you know, very early decided we wanted to reach the entire nation. It wasn't going to be enough for us just to target the medical students at our home institution. And understanding that required a lot of, you know, emails and a lot of cold emails to people and medical student deans all across the country, but people responded really favorably to it, and understanding that you can reach a larger community.
And so for anyone out there trying to start a business or a creative endeavor, what advice do you have for them?
I think the biggest advice is to do your research and do your homework. So one of the things that we did early on for example, in training is we basically got on Google and we Googled every single medical student writing group at a medical school, basically in the entire nation. And we literally were just Googling like writing group, medical student, narrative medicine, medical school, you know, every kind of iteration we could find, and coming and making this huge Excel list and just reaching out to these people and saying, hey, you know, we're so excited you have a narrative medicine or a writing group or an ethics writing group. We want to provide you a space for you to be able to publish your works. And people responded really favorably to that because, again, they were writing for these small communities and saying, hey, you know, why shouldn't we share these writings with the larger community? And so that's what I mean by do your homework, is really find who is kind of already in the niche you're serving and really reaching out to them and building connections. I can't tell you how many times in all of these years that I've been at conferences and like run into writers, or actually one of my editorial board members actually just started medical school at the University of Colorado. And, you know, I reached out to her and we grabbed coffee. I mean, it's amazing how small the community ends up feeling when you kind of reach broadly. Mm-hmm. So I think doing your homework on Google and all that, but I also think that reaching out on social media is also huge. I mean, we found pretty early on that on, for example, Twitter, there were tons of faculty and residents who were kind of involved in already in narrative medicine and in the medical humanities. And so we tweeted at them. We said, hey, you know, I noticed that you're doing all this, you know, medical humanities work. How about, you know, can you email or, you know, reach out to your students and see if they'd be interested in contributing to us? So I think, you know, again, using all of the internet and all of social media and really doing your homework and reaching out to, you know, you don't always have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, you don't have to reach all of these medical students de novo. I mean, there's plenty of people out there who can kind of serve as your liaisons to larger communities of people, and reaching out to those people and building connections, I think, is huge.
Yeah, it's really good advice. Another thing you once said in a blog post for Accepted, you basically said the skills of writing, reading, speaking, and critical analysis that are the foundation for participating in the media are also the skills that are necessary for engaging policymakers and educating the public. These skills are also integral for effective and humanistic patient care. So I really like that. I'm kind of curious what was behind that statement. And is this, you know, because essentially it sounds like you're talking about becoming a well-rounded physician and how that might also translate to effective patient care. But I'm kind of curious to hear your thought process.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what attracted me to internal medicine as a specialty in the first place is, you know, I'd spent all of college, you know, pounding the pavement on the ground, interviewing people. And what I found when I got to medical school is that the skill set that you needed to kind of interview someone about something that happened on campus or something that was going on was very, very similar, if not identical, to the same process of kind of interviewing a patient for a history and physical. I mean, it's a lot about, you know, balancing perfectly the open-ended question versus, you know, the review of systems, getting the yes or no answers while still being open to talking all about their own life narrative. I mean, so much of interviewing when you're, you know, working for a news publication is not just getting the quote, but also getting a sense of, you know, where that person you're interviewing comes from. What's their context? How do they approach the issue that you're trying to learn more about? And so I found that very familiar in internal medicine, which is, you know, ultimately why I you know, chose the field that I did. And what I found throughout medical school is that same process of being able to communicate with, you know, being able to write for a lay audience for the news publishing side was the same kind of thing as talking or writing for a lay audience for patients. I mean, you know, all the time in news journalism, we take complex issues and we want to present them authentically, but also present them in a way that's understandable to a wide audience. We do the same thing in clinical medicine every single day. And so, again, I saw all of those skill sets as being complementary. And of course, when you get into the realm of advocacy and working with policymakers, again, it's a lot about, you know, building your message. You know, a lot of what we do when we you know, either work in news publishing or when we talk to patients, when we talk to policymakers, is, you know, we kind of build some sort of message. You know, what are we trying to communicate to you, and why are we trying to communicate it? And so I found that all three of those kind of realms definitely had some very close similarities. And I think when it comes down to the end of the day, it's being able to communicate in an effective way and also being able to write. I mean, we write every day as physicians. I mean, we document, and documentation, yes, it's fraught with all of its, you know, coding and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, which when you're writing a consult note for someone, you're trying to communicate something that you have some expertise in a easy to understand way that allows them to glean some sort of, you know, education from it. It's the same thing we do with patients. It's the same thing we do with policymakers. I just think all of those skills are kind of part of a larger sphere of what it means just to be a great communicator.
Part of that multidimensional process is this concept of medicine plus that you've talked about. And I really like this idea of medicine plus because it's kind of what I'm trying to do and explore with Dr. Hustle. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to us about medicine plus and what does it mean for the future of healthcare?
Yeah, I think all of healthcare is going towards clinicians of all kinds being kind of medicine plus people. I mean, the day and age, I mean, you always hear this, the day and age of the triple threat physician has kind of gone by the wayside. I think, you know, just in my own clinical experience, you know, you find so many physicians who are trying to find their individual niche for something that they are doing. And so that's what medicine plus refers to. I mean, every time I go to a conference, I hear about these physicians who are doing this incredible work in areas of advocacy or writing, or, I mean, in my case, I consider, you know, publishing to be some of the work that I'm doing, or, you know, they have some individual niche in the area of research, or they have some individual niche in the area of, you know, communicating best with patients. I mean, that's what Medicine Plus really is, you know, people are wanting to become great clinicians, but they're always adding some unique and really fascinating niche to the work that they're doing. I think that's just the way that honestly all of medicine is going, is in a realm of people kind of specializing in one area and really dedicating themselves towards it and using it to further their careers and further further where medicine is going.
In training kind of came to the national scene when that article, A Lack of Care, Why Medical mm-hmm. Students Should Focus on Ferguson by Jennifer Tsai, went viral. Can you tell us about that article and kind of how it merged your journalistic side and your advocacy side and your medicine side kind of all in one?
Yeah, that piece by Jennifer Tsai was actually, I consider it to be one of those landmark pieces that has been published, at least during my tenure and in training. That was back in 2014. Primarily because it really opened the door of in training becoming a place for medical students to really talk about social justice and activism. That piece, Jennifer Tsai is really a phenomenal writer who's gone on to actually publish in the world of academic journals about the institutional racism that we have within medical education, and a lot of that kind of stemmed from the work that she did within training. That piece, when we published it, really, as you know, I had been doing a lot of activist work in my kind of own work in medical school, but it really made me start thinking about how in training could act as a force in kind of inducing a paradigm shift in a lot of the advocacy work. And for as an editor, really changed the way that I had to approach the publication, because, you know, when you're editing reflections and humanistic work, the way you approach that is vastly different from when you approach work that's really dealing with more controversial issues in the area of activism. And so that kind of really brought to a head how I had to really critically analyze those works before publishing. And as I mentioned now, I mean, that's a mainstay of what we publish on in training. My Stanford MedX talk really was supposed to be an amalgam of talking about how medical students were really not pleased with the institution of medicine as an ivory tower. And that is, I think, kind of a ubiquitous thread that has run throughout a lot of the work we've published on in training, is, you know, understanding that medicine is not purely a scientific kind of a pure scientific pursuit, but that it is very much influenced by the sociopolitical pressures at large. And so really that piece by Jennifer Tsai was really a landmark piece that I think, at least for in training, allowed us to really further delve into what medical students were really feeling and how displeased they were that their training did not seem to reflect what was actually going on with their patients. And you can see now, I talk to so many medical students now where they're really talking about issues of intrinsic bias, that they're getting formal training in their medical schools or getting formal training in advocacy and, you know, learning more about, free clinics and the socioeconomic determinants of health. I mean, a lot of that has really exploded kind of as buzzwords in the medical student scene and or medical education scene, rather. And I think a lot of that is because in the past couple of years, medical students have really wanted to fundamentally change their education and fundamentally able to better serve patients and kind of remove themselves from kind of this ivory tower of medicine. That's kind of what I wanted to address in that Stanford talk.
And do you think across the board that's working?
I think it's a little bit yes and no. And I think part of the issue overall with a lot of medical education is that there's a lot of standards and things are extraordinarily slow to change in medicine, but as well as in medical education. And I think most of the works that I think I've seen have been most successful, honestly, have been grassroots driven. My secret to why in training in-house and everything exists is I think that the best way to induce a paradigm shift in really everything is by doing something from a grassroots way. And so by having medical students have a place that's low barrier to entry to talk about these issues that they're passionate about and give them a voice where they may have not had a voice before is a way to build a grassroots community to really create sustainable change. A classic example here is at the University of Colorado. We have a free clinic run by the medical students that was actually started by one of my colleagues who's a resident, and it was started from the ground up. You know, it was started by medical students who were passionate about what they were doing, and it's now, existing into its, whatever year now. And again, all of that is successful because it came from a place of passion from within the community, not from a top-down approach. I don't always think that the reason I think a lot of these initiatives, may not be working to their best degree is because a top-down approach isn't always the best approach, I think. I think if you can't generate interest and passion within the kind of community that you're serving, I don't think a lot of initiatives honestly work that well. And again, a lot of things in medical education with building standards, et cetera, make things kind of complicated. But that's why I think it's important for communities like in training to exist, because I think medical students should have a place to be able to discuss those issues and kind of create their own future, regardless of where medicine or medical education kind of is.
Right. And related to that, you as a first year medical student, you gave a statement on behalf of the Albany Medical College chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program in support of a single payer system. So do you think in training or in-house has a place in policy, or are you keeping that more to the humanistic side of work? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think they absolutely have a place in policy. I've had actually one of our early in training writers was writing about medical marijuana in New York State and was writing for us on in training and eventually actually testified before New York State government as kind of a medical student on in favor of medical marijuana, and like ended up becoming instrumental and involved in a lot of the advocacy groups there. I mean, I think there's 100% a policy place, because let's face it, I mean, we as clinicians are always on the front lines of medicine and we are confronted day to day. I mean, as an emergency, physician in training is, we see the worst of the worst and what happens when people don't have good access to care and what happens when people, fall through the cracks of the healthcare system. So, with those narratives that we see day in and day out, we are in a very, very powerful place to interact with policymakers and share our stories. And there's plenty of physicians now, kind of physician advocates you see all over the country, who are really using their energies and their experience with patients to really kind of push some of those policies forward. So I think it's 100. Again, I think this is, and in training has had actually whole columns dedicated to it on issues of policy. I think that medical students are really becoming more involved in that work and want to bring it to the future careers. Again, leaving that ivory tower of medicine aside and really getting and pounding the pavement and wanting to get more involved with policy kind of at the local level.
And I'm kind of curious about your own evolution. from that first year as a medical student to now, how has your thoughts matured or changed about the healthcare system and a single payer system?
Yeah, I did a fair amount of single payer work during my medical student years. And, you know, into residency, I've evolved a little bit in that some of the kind of day-to-day advocacy work has been honestly challenging as a resident physician, just with the time constraints and being able to stay involved with my single payer colleagues. More of what I've been focusing on doing over the past couple of years is really working on providing anyone who's interested in anything relating to healthcare policy a platform with which to discuss those issues. A great example is on in-house. I started the social medicine theme issue. So every February we have a dedicated theme issue that talks about social medicine and being able to publish works. For example, a piece that was published not that long ago was from a family medicine resident physician talking about the importance of federally qualified health, the FQHC network in providing care and improving access to care for a number of citizens. So I think that's how I've evolved is, you know, I've done kind of more on the ground with a megaphone in hand, you know, type work. And I think I've now transitioned more to finding that my strength and what I really can give back to the community is more provide avenues for people to kind of talk about these issues.
And another one of your contributions to medicine is that you've given talks about having a social media presence. Can you talk about why having a social media presence is important?
Yeah, I love giving these talks because I think for a long time social media was kind of seen as being this taboo, thing that clinicians really shouldn't be involved with. But I think an instrumental part of having kind of a Medicine Plus platform is being able to build a brand and build your messaging. I mean, you know, you've been on Twitter that there's all of these physicians on Twitter who have kind of built these interesting niches for themselves. For example, I mean, emergency medicine is actually one of the best of this. There's all of these, you know, faux med, emergency medicine, kind of open access medical education communities that were started primarily by emergency physicians kind of on a national scale. I mean, that's a classic, an amazing example of what, you know, these social media communities can build. But I think that's what the key part of it is. If you do any work in advocacy, activism, and again, this goes back to if you want to start a project, you know, you got to do your research. You got to reach out to people who are already working in the community and seeing what they're doing, what works, and kind of what you can build upon. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. If you get out there and find that there's already people who are doing incredible activism work, you should join them. You should join them through the internet, through social media, and find what you and what your strength is that you can bring to the table. I've talked to a lot of physicians who do activism work who said that, you know, what they brought to the table was when they put on their long white coat and they went with a community of people to whatever, you know, lobby makers or what have you, you know, there was a certain, feeling of stature and legitimacy that they had as physicians bringing their patient stories to the table. And that's a great way to bring a strength and not reinvent the wheel.
Right. And do you have any advice for us on how to improve our social media game?
I think the biggest thing you have to keep in mind is finding the right niche for you. I think the biggest thing I see with some people who struggle with social media is usually wanting to do too much. You know, you look at their Twitter profile and they have like 400 hashtags in it about things they want to do. It's, you know, what really are you on social media for? You know, if your goal in life is to talk about empowering the chronic disease community, then that should be your niche and you should be reaching out to people. I think, again, it's finding the specific niche that you want to serve and really tailoring your message to that. And not suffering from having, you know, putting too much on your Twitter and everything kind of getting lost in the shuffle.
What does leadership mean to you?
I think, so I'm a big a believer in servant leadership, kind of the ethos kind of of leadership and, you know, leading by serving. I think that with all of my publications and with all the kind of work I've been doing that, you know, when you work alongside your colleagues and the people that you lead, I have always found that it's a better way to kind of build a cohesive, culture around whatever editorial board or organizational board that you have. So I think servant leadership is absolutely the way to go.
And I actually appreciate the fact that you were able to transition out of these editor-in-chief positions, because I feel like a lot of times people would just want to hold on to it as long as possible, that you kind of brought other people along.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason for that is Alina and I always, you know, I think a year and a half into when we started in training, we were already thinking like, okay, who's going to be the next editor-in-chief? And I think what that reflects is you always kind of have to really consistently reevaluate what will give your organization its longevity. I mean, if you're not thinking about, you know, if you're not thinking 5-10 years in the future, I think that you're doing your organization a disservice. I think you always have to, I mean, even to this day, when I, even talking to the in-training people, the in-training editors in chief are, because we built a culture of that thinking like, okay, who's going to be the next editor in chief? Who's going to be the next managing editor? What do we need to do to kind of find these people? So I think that's part of building the culture of a good organization.
Mm-hmm. All right. Another question I have for you is, what makes a good pitch?
Ooh, I think the best part about a pitch is really knowing your audience and knowing that you're going to have different pitches for different people. I think that's the one thing I've learned as I've, you know, spent many years kind of marketing and training people, is it totally depends on who you're talking to. The way that I talked about in training, the way I talk to in training about in training to medical students is vastly different than the way I talk it to faculty. And whether I'm talking to medical students who are working in the advocacy or activism realm is vastly different from those who I'm talking to who are more interested in like poetry and the medical humanities. So it's really about knowing your audience and having a couple pitches in the back of your mind that you can pull depending on where you are and who you're talking to.
What are your favorite posts on your publications? Do you have any favorites?
Ooh, that's actually, yeah. So in training, the piece is entitled M/R/G, which stands for Murmurs, Rubs, and Gallops. It's a piece that was written by Stephen Lange, who is a phenomenal poet who wrote for in training. God, this piece must have been back from 2015. It's this really beautiful, complex, kind of verbose poem about cardiology. You gotta read it.
That's awesome.
M/R/G. It's by Stephen Lange, back from I think March of 2015.
Cool. And all these, anything you mentioned, we're gonna be putting it on the show notes so that people can easily find it. What have been the most popular posts on your publications?
So by far the most popular post that's ever been published on in training is still the piece on Ferguson by Jennifer Tsai. To this day is mm-hmm. one of our most well-read posts. On in-house, actually, the most recent one that's been the most well-read is this chilling piece that we published back in May of this year entitled What Remains. It's written by a pediatric resident physician at New York Presbyterian / Cornell. That talks about this resident's experience as an intern in the pediatric intensive care unit. It's like a must read piece about the futility of a lot of the work, about medical futility and the futility of a lot of work we do.
Wow. And do you have any favorite authors or things you like to read?
Oh, it depends. Is this reading for fun or is this reading more for work?
For fun. Like what kind of makes you think, you know, and where do you get your ideas from and what kind of inspires you?
Yeah, I think the still one of the best pieces of medical literature I've ever read is probably the Checklist Manifesto, mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you're familiar with, by Atul Gawande. Mm-hmm. What I love about his work is that he seamlessly blends his passion for, you know, epidemiology with a lot of like QI and process improvement, which is something that I think we don't, I mean, we talk a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, as a resident, we do like QI work, but the way that he approaches kind of process improvement is distinctly iterative. And it also gets down really to being based in patient narrative. Like what I love about his work is that he starts, you know, the book talking about a patient who, you know, had basically got like a kind of a hospital acquired infection, and how that patient's singular narrative builds into the larger narrative of what quality improvement and process improvement are. And that's what I love about him, is that he always brings it down still to the individual patient. And I think that connection sometimes gets missed in a lot of the QI work. Like I think a lot of QI really should be based upon patients that we see and really understanding how we can kind of improve the processes by which, you know, good or bad things happen in medicine.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, in 5 years, I think I'll just be finishing fellowship, which I think will be a big relief. So I think 5 years, I'll be looking for a faculty job. I think 10 years from now, my personal interest in oncology is in the realm of malignant hematology and bone marrow transplant. So I would love to be working in a faculty position and doing a lot of clinical research with respect to my area of clinical interest right now is in the realm of lymphoma. And I also foresee myself in 10 years really having grown Pedro Publications to a real publishing house. I think in the next 10 years, with the amount of volume of pieces and kind of manuscripts that I've been receiving with Pedro Publications, I anticipate that at that point we will really have actually built more of an editorial team, and we'll have streamlined a lot of our processes by which we are, you know, reviewing and publishing work. So I really hope to see Pedro Publications be more of a publishing, like a real publishing house in 5-10 years.
That's really cool. And basically one more thing, because I'm really curious about how you manage your time, how you can keep all these things straight, you know. Do you have any tools that you use, any tricks that you use to kind of keep yourself on task every day?
You know what's funny is I kind of don't. And that's like there's – because, you know, people – I always talk to people about, like, you know, about organizational structure and how people – different people do it. I mean, first of all, I do almost everything on Google Drive of some kind. I'm the kind of person where, like, I'll be like, I was walking to get my hair cut today and I thought of something I needed to do, and I like texted I texted my own email address. I do a lot of that. And then kind of at the end of every day, I go through like a quick, and by a quick, I mean like a minute to 2 minutes tops, review of the things that were accomplished today and what needs to be accomplished tomorrow. And I use my Google Tasks app pretty religiously, mm-hmm. at kind of always reprioritizing what needs to get done. Because, you know, at the end of the day, things are changing throughout the day. I mean, like, you know, I, you know, got an email today about a research project, like a change that I need to do. And so that became a priority higher for me tomorrow. I think as long as but that's kind of something that I do pretty religiously. It's like, you know, before I go to bed at night, I go through my task list and I make sure I know what needs to be done tomorrow, what got accomplished today, and kind of what needs to be added, what needs to be removed, and kind of just making that a habit of every day is kind of what I do. But like, I'm kind of all over the place with a lot of emails to myself, a lot of texts to myself. That's kind of what I do.
But it works, right?
It works. It's awesome. I think it's about finding the system that works for you. And I sometimes find people, this is maybe getting up on my soapbox a little bit, who try to like religiously prescribe to one type of organizational method. But I think as long as you find something, even as cluttered as it is, that works, like, you know, if you're a Post-it, like, I know people who are Post-it kind of people and they get posted everywhere. It's like, as long as it works for you, you know, it works for you, whatever mm-hmm. kind of allows you to kind of focus in on the things that need to be accomplished now and what needs to be accomplished later. I think as long as it works, it works.
Cool. And then if anyone wants to get in contact with you, where can people find you?
So best way to email me is at my email address, which is aj@majoraj.com. So my website is majoraj.com. And I am down to chat to anyone about any ideas you have in and outside of medicine. I love collaboration, phone calls. You know, I think that's where I get a lot of ideas. And honestly, where I get a lot of the energy to do all the work that I do is just like talking to people and really like, I don't know, really talking about the future of what everything is going to look like. So yeah, feel free to shoot me an email, call, whatever.
Cool. And you seem like a pretty energetic guy. Have you ever done like a Myers-Briggs or anything like that?
Yes. And you will probably never guess what I am.
I want to start with an E.
Wrong.
Really?
Yes, I have taken Myers-Briggs a bunch of times. I am an INTJ.
Okay. All right.
Yes. I am distinctly an introvert who, at the end of a long day of socializing with people, I need some time to myself just uh-huh. to like chill and regroup my energy. But yes, I am weirdly, I guess, an INTJ. So
very cool, very cool. I'm an INTP.
So. There you go.
But
introvert buddies for life.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks very much for participating. I really had a good time listening to all these ideas that you have.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. This has been great.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King once said, "As my sufferings mounted, I soon realized that there were two ways in which I could respond to my situation, either to react with bitterness or seek to transform the suffering into a creative force. I decided to follow the latter course. The next time you are treating a patient, or perhaps you are even a patient, try to find the story, explore the emotions, and transform the suffering into that essential creative force. Dr. AJ Major and Pager Publications will be waiting for your submission.
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store, and please link to us on social media at dr_hustle on Twitter and at dr.hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at bassamzahid.com. Thanks for listening.